Chapter 4. The Spirit of the Hills. 2 months after the founding of the YMBA, a small, three-roomed building to the rear of the Dharmodya Vihara was opened for recreational purposes, and a month later, evening tutorial classes were started. Until the opening of the recreation hut, as we called it, our activities consisted mainly of lectures and educational film shows. In addition to Prince Peter, during the first 3 or 4 months of our existence, the main outside speakers were Professor N.C. Ahuja, a lecturer in agriculture from the Benares Hindu University, and Kanwal Krishna, a well-known Punjabi artist. Ahuja had had a wide experience of different methods of agriculture and dairying in England, Denmark, and South America, and we had become acquainted the previous year while I was staying with Kashyapji on the Benares Hindu University campus. He was a tall, fair-skinned, rather anglicised Punjabi Hindu with scarlet cheeks and black eyebrows and a bright, strangely wooden smile. Beneath the smile lurked a diabolical temper, and it was because he was worried about this temper that he first came to see me. I advised him to meditate, and thereafter he visited me regularly. He had come up to Kalimpong partly for a holiday, partly in order to renew his acquaintance with me, and partly to cast a professional eye on the agronomics of the area. The subject of his lecture was the development of the Himalayas. He began by giving a geographical survey of the Himalayan region, comparing it with the Andes and the Alps, and then enthusiastically declared that with proper agricultural development there could be a dozen Switzerlands in the Himalayas. The audience was suitably impressed, though I could see there was a need to improve the economic position of the Himalayan peoples. Personally, I was not sure if I wanted to see even one Switzerland in the Himalayas. On the contrary, I was perfectly content with them as they were. Kanwal Krishna's lecture was on art and education. Besides hearing him speak, I also saw the paintings he had brought with him to Kalimpong, as well as those of his wife, Devayani. On the whole, I preferred Devayani's more sensitive and restrained work to the bold and colourful studies of local scenes and local people, in which Kanwal Krishna had just done such a brisk trade in Gangtok. Perhaps I could not help showing my preference. Before their departure, Devayani presented the YMBA with a watercolour depicting Tibetan devotees before an image of the Buddha. With assistance from me as to spelling and grammar, Joe attempted a pen picture of this painting for Stepping Stones. Quote, "In the foreground, in rich maroon-coloured garments," he wrote, "are 6 devotees. 5 are seated, whilst the 6th is walking to the image to offer puja. Upon the altar, which is painted in yellows and carries the main light of the picture, are blue bowls and a pot wherein incense sticks are burning. From the altar, the sight is drawn upward to the image of the Lord Buddha. He rests upon a lotus seat in a preaching attitude and is painted in dark colours, the form being outlined in bold strokes of yellow where the light falls. The background holds the half-lights with brilliant touches of red to accentuate the head. On either side of the image, gay silken banners hang, yellow, blue, green, orange and red. The whole picture has a definite atmosphere of dignified reverence and is sufficiently mysterious to convey fully the impression of a temple interior. The colours, though vivid, have a harmony and quietness that pervades the whole work and leaves one with a feeling that the artist was never in doubt of the inner feeling this subject gave her." End of quote. When framed and hung, this beautiful painting gave great offence to our Tibetan friends. As Joe's pen picture failed to make clear, the artist had shown only the lower half of the Buddha's face, the rest not being included in the picture. What this was meant to convey was obvious. The devotees were worshipping that which ultimately transcended their understanding. The mystery of enlightenment was not to be confined within any conceptual framework. Our Tibetan friends saw things quite differently. According to them, what Devayani had done, plainly and simply, was to chop the Buddha's head in two. Thus, she was guilty of the offence of wounding the body of a Buddha, which, according to Buddhist tradition, was one of the five most heinous offences anyone could possibly commit, along with killing an arahant, parricide and matricide, and causing schism within the monastic order. Throughout the rest of the Buddhist world, wounding the body of a Buddha was understood to mean shedding the blood of a Buddha. A Buddha could not be killed, as Devadatta had done in the case of Shakyamuni, and it was therefore possible to commit the offence only while there was a Buddha actually alive in the world. As I now discovered, the Tibetans had a different interpretation. According to them, wounding the body of a Buddha was to be understood not just literally, but also metaphorically, even symbolically. Any image or other representation of the Buddha was itself a, inverted commas, body of the Buddha, and cutting or tearing it or defacing or disfiguring it in any way was in their eyes as much tantamount to wounding the body of a Buddha as stabbing the host was in the eyes of Roman Catholics, tantamount to stabbing the body of the Saviour himself. Yet though Devayani's painting gave such offence to our Tibetan friends, they did not react with the outrage, even the violence, with which Roman Catholics might have reacted in similar circumstances. Diffidently, but with evident disquiet, they drew our attention to the gravity of the offence, as they held it to be, that Devayani had committed, and left it to us to deal with the matter in whatever way we thought best. Educational film shows proved even more popular than lectures. At Swale's request, the United States Information Service lent us a projector, a screen, and other equipment, and sent a regular supply of films. Thus it was that twice a week, Nepalese, Tibetans, Sikkimese, Bhutanese, Indians, and Chinese, of all ages and every degree of literacy, crowded into the big downstairs room next to the library to see such films as Home Demonstration Work and All Around Arkansas, as well as the latest newsreel. So many people came, in fact, that after a few weeks we had to limit admission to YMBA members and associate members. Associate membership was open to women and to boys under the age of 12. Eventually the town club invited us to hold the shows at the town hall, which we did for quite a long time, showing the films once instead of twice a week, and attracting more and more people. Unfortunately, the fact that the films were supplied by the USIS and that Swale was given to making cheery remarks about YMBA activities keeping young men off the streets and away from communism led to a story going round the bazaar that we were American agents. Joe had by this time revealed himself as virulently anti-American, at least as far as words went. This story too did me no good. Though far from cancelling out Jan's story, it seemed to combine with it in some people's minds and make them more suspicious of me than ever, or at least to give them a pretext for being suspicious. Besides lectures and educational film shows, our activities during the first 3 months of our existence included a debate on the motion, quote, that the state should immediately enforce temperance. It was later defeated by one vote. And a tree planting festival. The latter took place, appropriately enough, shortly after Professor Ahuja's lecture, and was our contribution to the government-sponsored Tree Planting Week. A number of trees, both useful and ornamental, were planted within the precincts of the Dharmodya Vihara, the ceremony being inaugurated by Mochi Chand Pradhan, the subdivisional officer of Kalimpong, who planted the first tree. I had already met him more than once, usually on YMBA business. He was a tall, thin man of about 60, short-sighted, with a thatch of white hair, and a stoop so pronounced he always seemed to be in danger of overbalancing. Most of the time he lived in a sort of cloud, a cloud from which he emerged dimly from time to time to rub his hands together and do whatever was required of him. The cloud was Theosophy and Krishnamurti. He was, in fact, one of those lifelong Theosophists whose brains, not very strong to begin with, had been seriously weakened by contact with Krishnamurti and his teaching. Like a lot of other people, when I went to see him at his office, I found it almost impossible to get him to attend to the business on which I had come. All he wanted to do was to talk in a vague, woolly, wandering sort of way about Krishnamurti. Before becoming SDO, he had been second officer in Darjeeling, and his appointment to a post formerly occupied by a European had given great satisfaction to his fellow Nepalese, by whom he was widely esteemed for his inoffensiveness and his freedom from corruption. Whether because the government of West Bengal found that the Kalimpong subdivision did not run very well on Theosophy and Krishnamurti, or for some other reason, Mochi Chand was not only the first Nepali SDO, but also the last. During my stay in Kalimpong, I was to see many more SDOs come and go, but all of them were Bengalis. The recreation hut was tucked away behind the kitchen building at the foot of the vertical clay bank where the hillside had been cut away to form the ledge on which the vihara stood. It was really no more than a wooden shack, and in the days when the vihara was a European family residence, must have been the servants' quarters. At one time, chickens had been kept there. Before it could be used for recreational purposes, the whole place had to be cleaned out, repaired, and decorated. There were chicken droppings to be removed, leaks in the roof to be stopped up, walls to be scrubbed down and whitewashed. There was a wooden partition to be taken down in order to make a room big enough to hold the ping-pong table. And the ping-pong table itself had to be made, to our specifications, by a local carpenter. At length, everything was done, and the recreation hut declared open. Since electricity had not as yet been installed, it could be used only from 4 o'clock to 6 o'clock every afternoon, that is to say, from the time school and college finished to the time it grew dark. Before long, YMBA membership had more than doubled. The young men of Kalimpong felt that they now had a place of their own. In theory, the older youths, at least, could have joined the town club and played ping-pong and badminton in the town hall, but few of them could afford the monthly subscription, more than twice the cost of YMBA membership for a whole year. And in any case, they did not feel wholly at ease there, as the club was patronised mainly by government officers and members of the Bengali ruling elite. To the YMBA, then, in ever-increasing numbers, the young men came. Much as they enjoyed playing ping-pong and carom-board in the recreation hut, and badminton on the court we had marked out on the patch of ground beside the kitchen, our school and college-going members were not unmindful of more serious matters. Little victims they might be, and play they certainly did, but they were little victims who did not play regardless of their doom. In their case, doom meant the examinations for which they had to sit towards the end of the year. Examinations were important because passing was important. Passing was important because passing gave you, eventually, a scrap of paper stamped qualification. A qualification was important because it secured you, if you were lucky, a job, that is to say a white-collar job, preferably in government service, that not only lifted you from the uneducated and insolvent masses to the educated and relatively solvent classes, but also ensured that you and your family would be provided for the rest of your days. Education was not so much the gateway to knowledge as the bridge to success in life. Below the bridge yawned the abyss of poverty, degradation and despair. In Calcutta, when the examination results were announced, there was always a crop of suicides. Failed matriculates, IAs and BAs, would throw themselves into the waters of the Hooghly or under the wheels of trains, unable to face the reproachful or despairing looks of parents and elder brothers who had slaved and starved to keep them at school or college for another year and who would not be able to repeat the effort. In the hills, the economic situation was not as bad as that, and the pressure to pass examinations not nearly so great. Most Nepalese families lived in a wattle and daub hut they had built themselves and owned a plot of land on which they could grow maize and squash, raise chickens, and if they were of sufficiently low caste, even fatten a few pigs. Nevertheless, though the pressure to pass examinations and obtain the magic qualification was not nearly so great as it was in the cities of the plains, it was strong enough, and as the weeks went by, the cheerful faces of our young friends became more and more clouded with gloom. Most of them were convinced that they stood little chance of passing their examinations unless they received private tuition. Such tuition was available in the evenings for a consideration from the self-same teachers who taught them at school or college during the day. To me, it was strange that private tuition should be so necessary, and stranger still that the students should have to take it from their own school and college teachers. One would have thought that the teaching they received in class during the day would have been quite sufficient. If it was not, why did their teachers not improve their methods of teaching? Why did they not give their students more homework? The school and college-going members to whom I put these questions only met them with smiles of incredulity. More homework? Their teachers never gave them any homework. They did not even teach them properly in class during the day. All they were interested in was getting students to take private tuition from them in the evenings for a consideration. Some students maintained that however well they did in the internal, that is the school or college, examinations, their teachers would fail them unless they were going to them for private tuition. And if they failed the internal examinations, they could not sit for the external examinations, which of course were the ones that mattered. All of them believed that, with few exceptions, their teachers regarded school and college classes simply as recruiting grounds for private pupils. One teacher had even fitted up a room in his bungalow like a classroom, complete with desks, and he had so many pupils and had made so much money that although he had been in Kalimpong for only a few years, he was in Bengali from Calcutta, he had been able to buy two substantial properties. Private tuition really was necessary. They all felt the need of it, and they were all prepared to take it if they could get it, even if this meant having to sacrifice all their free evenings from now on to the time of the examinations. There was only one difficulty. In most cases, they, or rather their parents, could not afford to pay for private tuition. They already had to pay the school or college fees, as well as to provide their own textbooks and writing materials, and the additional expense was simply beyond their means. Once they were assured of a sympathetic hearing, the young men voiced their grievances quite freely. But though they spoke reasonably enough, I sensed that beneath their growing gloom there was a strong undercurrent of bitterness and resentment. Life had stacked the odds too heavily against them, they seemed to feel. Without a qualification, you could not get a decent job. Without passing your examinations, you could not get a qualification. Without private tuition, you could not pass your examinations. Without money, you could not pay for private tuition. Everything depended upon money. Money was the greatest of all blessings, lack of money the greatest curse. With money, you could do anything. Without it, you could do nothing. Usually you, or rather your parents, did not have money. Even if they did have, usually they would refuse to spend it on private tuition for you. You just had to study harder. The only reason why students failed to pass their examinations, you would be told, was laziness. A student had no business to be doing anything, day or night, except studying. Parents always refused absolutely to listen to any complaint against the teachers. This undercurrent of bitterness and resentment was strongest in the Nepali and Tibetan-speaking students, most of whom came from communities officially regarded as being socially, economically and educationally backward. Besides having to suffer on account of their parents' poverty or lack of understanding, they were the victims of communal prejudice and religious bigotry. Bengali teachers tended to favour Bengali students, while Christian teachers tended to favour students who were either Christians already or who were at least willing to go to church. Most of our student members attended the Scottish Mission High School, the undeclared policy of which was to appoint Christian rather than non-Christian teachers. Life could be difficult if you were a student in Kalimpong. It could be still more difficult if you were a student and poor. And most difficult of all, if you were a student and poor and a Nepali or Tibetan-speaking Hindu or Buddhist. Clearly, we would have to give whatever help we could to our school and college-going members. But for the time being, at least, that help would have to be given within the framework of the existing educational system. In the first week of August, therefore, a month after the opening of the recreation hut, and 3 months after the establishment of the YMBA, evening tutorial classes were started and continued for the next 4 months. Their original purpose was to assist YMBA members preparing for the matriculation and intermediate arts examinations. But very soon, in response to popular demand, we had to enlarge them so as to include Class 8 and Class 9 students, who wanted help in preparing themselves for their own examinations. The subjects in which all the students were weakest were English, mathematics, and in the case of IA students, logic. And on these we decided to concentrate. Joe took Class 8 and Class 9 students for English. He could at least give them conversational practice, which they badly needed. Swale took students of all classes for mathematics, while I took the matriculation and IA students for English and logic. Classes were held from 4 o'clock to 6 o'clock in the afternoon, and no fees were charged. Most students came to the Vihara straight from school, or if they happened to live in the bazaar, after dashing home and gulping down a cup of tea. Initially, about 40 students attended the different classes each day, but as the weeks went by and examinations, both internal and external, drew ever nearer, numbers rose, first from 40 to 50, then from 50 to 60. With so many students coming for tuition each day, we were rather hard-pressed for space. In the end, Joe took his students in the room he had been given downstairs, while Swale used the big room next to the library where we held our lectures. As for me, I took my students in the corresponding room upstairs, which was my bedroom, study, editorial office, dining room and reception room. At the close of the two-hour session, there will be a general stampede to the recreation hut. Having devoted themselves to their studies for the greater part of the day, most of the students felt that they could now throw aside their books and enjoy themselves for a while with a clear conscience. Gradually, some of them got into the habit of spending altogether anything from 4 to 6 hours at the Vihara every evening. This was not just because they enjoyed playing ping-pong, carom board and draughts, and the other games we provided. It was not just because they enjoyed one another's company. In some cases, it was at least partly due to the fact that when they went home, it would be to a hut full of younger brothers and sisters, where the only light was that of a paraffin lamp,
where there was no quiet corner, and where, more likely than not, a stern father would expect them to sit up studying long after the rest of the family had gone to bed. The opening of the recreation hut and the starting of the tutorial classes made quite a difference to life at the Vihara, especially during the latter part of the day. Mornings remained more or less unchanged. When I had finished my puja and meditation, Joe and I had breakfast together in my room, after which I studied or got on with editorial work or wrote letters, while he either went curio hunting in the bazaar or smoked and typed in his own room. Sometimes we spent the morning talking. Since we were not only working together for the YMBA, but also staying in the same building, I soon got to know him quite well, much better than I had been able to get to know Swale. Like me, he had had little formal education, the difference being that he had not had it for a much longer time and minded that he had not had it. His appreciation of the cultural achievements of humanity and his feeling for beauty in all its forms were both unusually intense, though he had a tendency to think of culture in terms of what was rare and costly, even simply luxurious. No less intense was his desire to make a personal contribution to culture, to create something beautiful himself. But here he was badly handicapped by his lack of the basic techniques. Whether he tried to compose a haiku, or write an article for Stepping Stones, or paint a picture, it simply would not go right, and he was left feeling frustrated and emotionally exhausted. He was also left feeling bitter and resentful. Because he had not had the advantage of a proper education and lacked basic creative skills, the two things seemed to be connected in his mind, Joe in fact suffered from acute feelings of inferiority and inadequacy and cherished a strong sense of grievance against society, especially against those who were better educated or technically more competent than he was. As in the case of Philoctetes, his very defects were not without their corresponding advantages. Oversensitive as he was in matters of education and artistic technique, he was quick to detect, even to pounce upon, any attempt to use these to conceal poverty of thought or failure of inspiration. Technical virtuosity for its own sake particularly enraged him. It was, in inverted commas, clever, one of the most damning words in his vocabulary. With this ability to see through pretense and insincerity in a poem, a novel, a play, or a picture, or even in a person, not that he did not have his blind spots, Joe excelled in destructive criticism of the more ferocious type. He was never happier than when he was tearing something to pieces. If he could also trample on the fragments, so much the better. Destructive criticism gave him an outlet for his feelings of frustration, bitterness, and resentment in a way that nothing else did. It enabled him to express emotions of indignation, scorn, contempt, and disgust, as well as to indulge in irony, ridicule, sarcasm, and invective. Destructive criticism permitted him to, inverted commas, be himself. To a greater extent than anyone I had yet known, he was most creative when he was most critical. In fact, it was only by being critical that he could be creative at all. Besides indulging his penchant for destructive criticism and relating anecdotes of his life in Lucknow with the Anglo-Indian family, Joe from time to time alluded to the facts of his army career. These allusions were so rare and couched for the most part in such vague and general terms that I was left with the impression that the whole subject of the army and his connection with it made Joe quite uneasy and that he was being deliberately evasive about it. On one occasion or another, I gathered that he had joined the British regular army at an early age, that he had served in India as an ordinary ranker, that he'd been commissioned during the war, and that he had spent the war years doing some kind of administrative work in Assam. And that was about all. Though he had lived in India for most of his life, unlike Swale, who was fluent in several Indian languages, he spoke only a few words of Hindi, all of which he habitually mispronounced. He also mispronounced, deliberately it seemed, not to say defiantly, such Pali Buddhist words as he knew. The Vihara, for instance, was always the Wiha. To pronounce the words of a foreign language correctly, even to pronounce one's own language correctly, was simply being clever in his words. Though his allusions to his army career were for the most part couched in vague and general terms, there was one part of it about which he reminisced repeatedly and at considerable length. This was the mess Christmas party. The mess Christmas party always ended with a dance. At the dance, they always wore fancy dress. Joe himself, then a sprightly young ranker, had always dressed up as a woman, wearing a tight-fitting silk dress, high-heeled shoes, and lots of rouge, lipstick, and mascara. Not only that, he had danced with the officers. Whenever he reached this point in the story, Joe went off into a series of high-pitched cackles, crossing and uncrossing his legs, hugging himself, and rocking violently backwards and forwards in his chair. Dancing with the officers was not, however, the climax of the story. The climax came later, with someone whispering in his ear, and apparently somebody always did whisper, "Joe, you've got the face of an angel and the eyes of a devil." A description which, despite his grey hair and gaunt features, Joe seemed to think entirely appropriate even now. Appropriate or not, there was no doubt that Joe's reminiscences of Christmas Day in the mess related to a period of his life that had ended some years, even some decades earlier. This was not to say that he had undergone a complete transformation during the interval. In some respects, the young ranker who had dressed up as a woman and danced with the officers was still very much alive. And though he may not have been much in evidence at our morning talks, he certainly showed himself on other occasions. Generally, the old woman who lived in the kitchen building prepared breakfast and lunch for us. This did not involve much more than boiling a pot of rice, and sometimes Joe did the work instead. When this happened, I could be pretty certain that, for breakfast at least, I would get a brass goblet filled with rice, into which he had stuck, upright, half a peeled banana. This dish, which was of his own invention, he called phallic rice. He always carried it up the stairs to me himself, depositing it in front of me with a flourish and glaring at me through his spectacles as he did so, as if to say, "Refuse it if you dare." Soon after getting to know me, Joe had come to the conclusion that I was not only young, but very naive, that I had no experience of things, quote, in the raw, and badly needed to be taught the facts of life. In the afternoon, after an early lunch, I still took no solid food after midday. I did more editorial work, talked with Swale and anybody he might have brought with him to see me, and prepared my lessons for the evening. One afternoon, sitting on my bed as usual, I looked out of the open window to see Swale assisting a peppery-looking old gentleman of about 70 up the last of the steps. This was Dr. Joseph Rock, a noted American anthropologist who had recently returned from the jungles of Western China and was now staying at the Himalayan Hotel with his Austrian secretary. As soon as he caught sight of me, the old gentleman called out, "Colonel Ryan says he's a monk, just like you. Is it true?" "No, it isn't," I called back promptly. "He's an Anagarika." "There, I told you so," exclaimed Dr. Rock triumphantly, turning to Swale. "You're not a monk." "I belong to a different order from him," Swale protested, rather weakly, I thought. From 3:30, the vihara started filling up with young men. Despite the fact that they already had a day of school or college behind them, they were rarely late, and indeed seemed to look forward to their evening tutorial classes. Having left shoes and sandals in the back hall, and having leapt up the stairs, two at a time, in their bare or stockinged feet, the students of each of my own two classes came crowding into my room with broadly smiling faces, most of them bidding me a cheerful good evening, sir, as they took their places on the floor in front of me and pulled out their books and notebooks. Sitting on my bed with my back to the window, I took first the Class 10 or matriculation students for English, then the intermediate students for English and logic, one class playing ping-pong and carom board in the recreation hut, while the other studied with me. Altogether, I had not less than 30 students, the greater number of them being in the lower class. Most of the students were in their late teens. Ethnically, religiously and linguistically, they were quite a mixed lot, as were the students in the classes taken by Joe and Swale. Features ranged from the definitely mongoloid, high cheekbones, slant eyes and hairless faces, to the definitely Aryan, prominent noses and incipient beards and moustaches, while complexions varied from blue-black to pinkish-white and from dark brown to light yellow. Some students were high-caste Hindus, others tribal Buddhists. There were locally born Nepalis and Tibetans, as well as Sikkimese from the protectorate of Sikkim, and Indians from the states of Bihar, East Punjab and Rajputana. Some students had Nepali for their mother tongue, some Tibetan, and some Hindi. Several spoke two of these languages, or even three. Among the Hindus, who overlapped with the Nepalis and Indians, there were a dozen different castes, and among the Nepalis, who overlapped with the Hindus and the Buddhists, a dozen different tribes. The typical student, however, tended to be mongoloid rather than Aryan in appearance, light brown rather than dark brown in complexion, Hindu rather than Buddhist, speaking Nepali as his mother tongue rather than Tibetan or Hindi, and occupying a lower rather than a higher place in the caste system. Despite the diversity of their ethnic, religious and linguistic backgrounds, our student members were characterised by a surprising unanimity of outlook. This was not only because they all belonged to approximately the same age group and were in any case all students, and as such all undergoing the same educational process. It was mainly because they were all subject to powerful influences emanating ultimately from the urban, industrial and secular civilization of the modern Western world. These influences reached them partly through the educational process itself. English was still the medium of instruction at high school and college level. Partly through the third-rate English, that is, English and American films shown at the local cinema. And partly through the mass-produced consumer goods sold in some of the local shops, as well as in 100 other more indirect ways. Almost without exception, they saw these influences as entirely beneficent. For them, the modern Western world was a world of progress, and its civilization was the glittering culmination of centuries of human effort. America in particular was heaven upon earth. It was everybody's dream come true, a place of unrestricted personal freedom and unlimited affluence. If any of them ever looked to Russia, it was because communism seemed to offer a speedier way of bringing to the people of India the kind of material prosperity already enjoyed by the people of America. Yet, bedazzled though they all were by the brilliance of the results achieved by modern Western science and technology, the students had by no means lost contact with their own particular cultural traditions. In fact, they were more deeply influenced by them than they realised. For them, their own cultural traditions represented the past, and the past was something they took for granted. Modern Western civilization represented the future, and the future they did not, indeed could not, take for granted. Thus, although they stood with their backs to the past, they had their faces turned to the future. It was with the future, as represented by modern Western civilization, that they sought to identify. It was the future they wanted to inherit. One of the ways in which they showed their unanimity of outlook and the extent to which they sought to identify with modern Western civilization was in the matter of dress. Almost without exception, they had discarded the Nepalese or Tibetan or Indian traditional costume still worn by the majority of their elders and adopted a simplified version of modern Western dress, which meant that they wore long trousers, or pants, as they always called them in American fashion, and an English-style shirt with, as the weather grew colder, a pullover or a jacket. Practically the only students to resist the rising tide of sartorial conversion were a Nepalese Brahmin youth who wore jodhpurs and a long, double-breasted Nepalese shirt, and a young Mawari who wore dhoti. In Peaks and Lamas, the book that had so much impressed me 5 years earlier when I was in Singapore, the author Marco Pallas, who was living in Kalimpong and whom I was soon to meet, had much to say on the subject of traditional costume, or national costume, as he also called it, though the two expressions are not really synonymous. According to him, the question of costume, external though it might appear at first sight, was a crucial one for India, China, Japan, and other nations too. He believed it had become a, quote, symbol of something far more deep-seated, a touchstone by which the traditional and anti-traditional souls could be distinguished, end of quote. By this criterion, our students were as a body decidedly among the anti-traditionists. When I asked them why they did not wear their traditional costume, whether Nepalese, Tibetan or Indian, at that time and for some years afterwards, I tended to adhere to Marco Pallas's rather simplistic views on the subject, they generally replied that traditional costume was uncomfortable and inconvenient and took a long time to put on. Western dress, on the contrary, was both comfortable and convenient, and one could slip into it in a few minutes. Though not the whole truth, this was not altogether a rationalisation. It took quite a long time to squeeze into the tight-fitting Nepalese jodhpurs, while the double-breasted Nepalese shirt had quite a lot of tapes that needed tying together, some of them right under the armpit where they were difficult to get at. In the Tibetan chuba, one could not move one's limbs freely, and it was difficult to run. As for the Indian dhoti, the way in which it revealed the inside of the leg right up to the crotch was positively indecent, a verdict with which I was inclined to agree. Though their insistence that traditional costume was uncomfortable and inconvenient was not wholly a rationalisation, there was little doubt that the real reason for the students' wholesale adoption of Western dress was simply that it was Western. By adopting it, they identified themselves, at least to some extent, with modern Western civilization. It was the uniform of the army under whose banner they wished to march, the banner on which was inscribed the magic word progress, and as such they were proud to wear it. While Marco Pallas was right in seeing in the abandonment of national costume a symbol of alienation from tradition, from traditional culture and traditional spiritual values, nonetheless, the students' preference for Western dress was not altogether a bad thing. Tradition, or what passed for tradition, was by no means an unmixed blessing. In any case, it existed not in one form, but in many different forms. Consequently, there were many different traditional cultures in existence, and as many different types of traditional costume. Was it necessarily a good thing that one's dress should immediately identify one as a Nepalese Hindu, or an Indian Muslim, or a Tibetan Buddhist? or proclaim to the world that one belonged to a higher or lower caste. The students did not think so. As recently as 1947, differences of nationality and culture, acutely felt, had been responsible for inflicting untold misery on millions of people in India and Pakistan, and had in fact been responsible for the eventual partition of the subcontinent. And in their view, the less such differences were given prominence by the wearing of a distinctive traditional costume, the better. All that dress should do was to make clear that one was an educated human being. Though they may not have consciously thought in such terms, the students preferred Western dress not only because they wanted to identify with modern Western civilization, but because they wanted to identify with one another. Unlike traditional costume, which in effect meant many different traditional costumes, Western dress was a means of emphasizing what they had in common with one another rather than what separated them. What they had in common, what united them, was that they are all young men, all students, and that, having come under the influence of modern Western civilization, they all shared the same progressive outlook, all looked forward to the same secular millennium. Western dress also served to remind them that they were all primarily human beings and only secondarily members of the particular ethnic and cultural group into which they had been born. One of the reasons why they had been drawn to the YMBA in the first place, in fact, was that it aimed to unite the young men of Kalimpong, as well as to propagate the teachings of the Buddha by means of social, educational and religious activities, and that membership was open to all who accepted these objects, regardless of race, caste, economic position and nominal religious affiliation. What they had not yet realised, perhaps I had not yet realised it fully myself, was that genuine unity was not possible on the basis of any secular notion of equality, but only on the basis of common commitment to a common spiritual ideal. Since the students were coming to the Vihara every day, as examinations drew near, they came even on Saturdays and Sundays. I soon got to know my own matriculation and IA students quite well. First I became familiar with their faces, then I learnt their names, and finally I tried to find out more about their backgrounds than was possible to infer from their cognomens and agnomens, and from their actual physical appearance. Sometimes my efforts produced unexpected results. "Who is your father?" I inquired one day of a determined-looking youngster with a protruding underlip, who might have been either Tibetan or Sikkimese. People I already knew sometimes stopped me in the bazaar to ask how their sons were getting on, and it was important to be able to connect the right offspring with the right parent. "My father is Mr. La Tsering," replied the youngster promptly, though with a grin that could have indicated either defiance or embarrassment. At the name of Mr. La Tsering, there was a burst of good-natured laughter from the rest of the class. Mr. La Tsering, as everybody knew, was the head of the Kalimpong branch of the Central Intelligence Bureau. But it was not this circumstance that was responsible for the laughter, as I then thought, but something of a quite different character, about which I learned only months later, after I had become acquainted with La Tsering himself. Another student, who, judging from his appearance, might also have been of either Tibetan or Sikkimese stock, turned out to be the grandson of someone much better known, and certainly far more distinguished, than the formidable boss of the local intelligence network. A gentle, fair-skinned youth, he was the son of an inspector in the West Bengal police force, who, in his turn, was the son of the famous Lama Kazi Dawa Sandup, whose translations of the Tibetan Book of the Dead, The Life of Milarepa, and other works formed the backbone of Dr. W. Y. Evans Wentz's celebrated Oxford Tibetan series. Alas, young Sandup could tell me little about his illustrious grandfather, and indeed did not appear to be particularly well-versed in Buddhism, though it may have been that he gave this impression simply because he was not accustomed to expressing himself in English on the subject. At least he was studying classical Tibetan, and it was to be hoped that one day he too would be a translator of Buddhist texts. Among the students who came most regularly, and whom I got to know best, this may have been partly due to the fact that they were more fluent in English than many of the others, there were five or six who seemed to be on particularly friendly terms with one another, and who, since they formed a fairly closely knit group, seemed to give a lead to the other boys. The members of this little fraternity were all between 16 and 18 years of age. They all lived in the bazaar, and all attended the Scottish Mission High School. Jungi Bahadur Gautam, the youngest of the group, was a short, cheerful Nepali about whose background I never learnt very much. Though the son of a Brahmin, his mother belonged to a lower caste, he was fonder of sports and games than of his books, and eventually gave up his studies to pursue a career in professional football. Padamlal Periyar was the handsomest of the group. In complexion, he was extremely dark, but with lotus eyes and finely cut features, such as one sees in the Ajanta frescoes. His father was a tailor and had a little shop on the way down to the lower bazaar. Whenever I passed by, I would see the grey-headed old man sitting behind his antiquated sewing machine facing the street, and he always rose to his feet and smilingly saluted me with folded hands. Lachuman Gazamaya was the group's pessimist. Though his expression was cheerful enough, he always looked on the gloomy side of things. This may have been due to the fact that, though tall and well-built, he had a sickly yellowish-brown complexion and was not really very healthy. His father worked for the Kalimpong municipality and was a bent, wizened little man who looked about 60, but was probably much younger. Unlike Jungi, Padam and Lachuman, who were all Hindus by birth, Kaka Bahadur Lama belonged to a Tamang Buddhist family. Tall and thin and gaunt, with clothes that seemed to flap upon him, he had a pale face and was of a somewhat choleric disposition. He was also the oldest member of the group. His family background was rather complicated. His father, a retired police inspector, even more advanced in years than Lachuman's father, was conducting a liaison with the Hindu Niwar widow of a Sikkimese liquor shop keeper. The liaison was so well established that it probably would be more correct to speak of old Mr. Lama as living polygamously, with one wife up at Tenth Mile. Localities along the main road were generally known after the ordinals of their miles up from Teesta Bridge. The Vihara was situated just above Ninth Mile, and the other wife down in the lower bazaar, except that, owing to Christian missionary influence, polygamy was rather frowned upon in the area, and English-educated people, at least, did not usually admit to practising it. The situation was further complicated by the fact that, according to popular report, his father supported one wife, Kaka's mother, and her children, with the help of money derived from the other, who had a grown-up son of her own, together with whom she managed the liquor shop and ran a motor transport service. Despite his years and the stiffness with which he moved, old Mr. Lama was in many ways sprightly enough. Unlike most of his contemporaries, he wore a Western-style suit and a trilby hat, which he raised ceremoniously whenever he met Joe or me in the street. What was more, alone among his contemporaries, he refused to submit to the indignity of a toothless, mumbling old age, and had instead invested in a complete set of false teeth, some of them made of gold. Dawa Tsering Bhutia, the only other Buddhist member of the group, was a Darjeeling-born Tibetan who had lost his father at an early age. His mother was away in England with an English family for whom she worked as an ayah. In her absence, Dawa lived with an uncle who stood in loco parentis. Though he was a friendly, good-natured youth, Dawa's smooth face often wore a worried look, as though he was trying to work something out, and he was inclined to be secretive. He also had a streak of hot temper, which he claimed he had inherited from his mother, a lady for whom he felt a mixture of love and terror. She was a strict disciplinarian and beat him frequently, very hard. Her two great fears were that he would become a drunkard like his father and that he would marry a non-Tibetan girl. Just as the little fraternity gave a lead to the rest of the students, so there was one member of the group who seemed to give a lead to the group itself. This was a 17-year-old Nepali called Sachindra Kumar Singh. In appearance, he was of medium height, with a slender, graceful figure, and features that were a perfect blend of the Mongoloid and the Aryan. He had not been coming to the Vihara long, or been in my matriculation class for more than a few days, even a few hours, before I was made aware of the qualities which, as I soon discovered, gave him so much influence over his contemporaries and made him such a general favourite. Besides being extremely lively and full of fun and mischief, he was possessed of such an extraordinary charm that it was quite impossible to refuse him anything. At the same time, he was well-spoken and well-mannered, with a natural modesty that added to his charm, if that was possible, and only half-concealed an equally natural self-assurance. His only faults were that he was, as one might have expected, rather too fond of his own way, and a little too inclined to play the tyrant. Sometimes he played the tyrant to such an extent that the other members of the group rebelled, but he had only to exercise this charm, and they once again submitted to his rule, though at times not without a few grumbles. Years later, in a book by Rumer Godden called Black Narcissus, I encountered a character who, in respect of his effect upon other people, reminded me very much of Sachin when I first met him. The character in question is a young Nepalese prince whose family sends him to a European school in the green, jungle-clad foothills of the eastern Himalayas, somewhere near Darjeeling. With his beauty and his charm, he appears to the nuns who have started the school and who are trying to make a success of the venture to be the very incarnation of the spirit of the hills, the dangerous pagan spirit they are seeking to overcome with their Christian teaching. Every day the young prince arrives at the school wearing a different coat of colourful silk brocade, each one more dazzling than the last. Sachin was not a prince, and he did not wear coats of colourful silk brocade, but from the effect he produced when he appeared at the Vihara, he might just as well have done. Once again, it was as if a beautiful and exotic butterfly had fluttered across my path. Or rather, this time, it was as if the butterfly was fluttering along the path with me, now alighting on my hand, now alighting on my shoulder, and now dancing on ahead of me down a sunlit track bordered with brilliant orange marigolds and multicoloured zinnias. With a beauty and a charm that in his case did not need to be set off by a splendid costume or by the consciousness of distinguished social position, Sachin too appeared to be the very incarnation of the spirit of the hills. It was the spirit of the hills that fluttered along the path with me and danced on ahead down the sunlit track. For was not the butterfly, according to the ancients, the symbol of the psyche, the soul? And could there not be a soul or spirit of a place as well as of a person? This spirit, the spirit of the hills, was not dangerous and pagan, as Rumer Godden's nuns believed, or rather, it was dangerous only when thwarted, and pagan only in the sense of being the source of life and joy. Sometimes Sachin seemed to incarnate something more than the spirit of the hills. Just turned 17, he was at the age when, according to Indian Buddhist tradition, the male human form is at the peak of its development, and when, strong without being clumsy, graceful without being weak, it can most fittingly represent the ideal of the infinitely wise and boundlessly compassionate Bodhisattva, who, with Nirvana seemingly within his grasp, renounces forever his own enlightenment and turns back to the world of suffering humanity to succour and to save. Thus it was that the young Nepali sometimes appeared strangely Bodhisattva-like, as though one of the beautiful golden figures that one saw in the dimness of Tibetan temples had stepped down from its lotus throne, where it had been pensively sitting beside the greater golden figure of the Buddha, and had wandered among the hills and through the streets of Kalimpong to the Vihara. In actual fact, of course, Sachin's origins were much more mundane, though his background still differed somewhat from that of the other members of the group. He came from a rather westernized Hindu family and lived not so much in the bazaar as on the edge of it, in a bungalow attached to the Scottish Mission Hospital, where his father worked as a doctor. Both his parents were originally from Darjeeling, and several female relations on his mother's side had married Bengalis. The better I got to know Jungi, Padam, Lachuman, Kaka, Dawa and Sachin, and the better they got to know me, the more there developed between us something akin to friendship. The reason for this development was not so much that they were fluent in English or were members of a closely knit group, but rather that they gradually got into the habit of staying on after their class and talking with me. Sometimes we continued our talk in the recreation hut, and sometimes I challenged one or another of them to a game of ping-pong. Carrom board, which was a great favourite with most of the boys, I thought boring. Usually I played either Sachin or Lachuman, as the three of us were fairly evenly matched and able to keep one another on our toes. According to orthodox Buddhist ideas, it was not at all proper for a monk to play games, and I well knew that in the most rigidly correct Buddhist circles, my conduct would be severely reprehended. Yet I could not really believe that it was morally wrong for me to play ping-pong with my students, and even that it was simply unbecoming for one who had gone forth to spend time in this way. Playing ping-pong with the students helped me to develop a closer relationship with them. A rigorous Theravadin might have questioned the utility of this. It also gave me an outlet for my physical energies, an outlet I probably needed more than I realised. Such is the influence of convention, however, and such the pressure of group attitudes on the individual, that even though I could not really believe it was morally wrong or even unbecoming for me to play ping-pong, the fact that I knew my behaviour would meet with widespread disapproval gave me a certain amount of uneasiness. Sometimes, instead of playing ping-pong, we went for a walk, on one occasion going as far as 14th Mile, where the main road became a dusty yellow mule track and the houses on either side gave way to clumps of tall bamboo. More often than not, we would be joined in our talks and excursions by Joe, who had also got to know Jungi, Padam and the rest of the five or six members of the little fraternity. It was noticeable that Joe's relations were closest with Jungi, Padam and Kaka, whereas mine were closest with Sachin, Lachuman and Dawa. It was also noticeable that within the fraternity itself, relations were closest between Sachin, Lachuman and Padam. This may or may not have had something to do with the fact that, as I discovered later, they belonged to the same Nepali Hindu caste and that this was a very low one. The subject of caste was in fact quite a sore one with them, and one of the reasons why they were attracted to Buddhism and to the YMBA was that it was well known that the Buddha had criticised the Brahminical system of hereditary caste, teaching that what really counted was not birth, but worth. One of Padam's sisters was indeed married to the celebrated Indian Buddhist scholar Rahul Sankrityayanam, who had once been a Buddhist monk, and who had spent a few weeks at the Dharmodi Vihara the previous year. Kamala Periyar had come to the Vihara each day to type for Rahulji, as he was universally known, and one day the two of them were found in the same compromising embrace in which great wisdom and the Nuwa widow had been discovered. Such was the outcry that Rahulji, who had disrobed some years earlier and was now in his 50s, was obliged to abandon the Vihara and take refuge in a hotel. When he left Kalimpong, he took Kamala with him and subsequently married her. Once again, the Nuwa's pious custom of removing their shoes in the hall and stealing upstairs in their stockinged feet had had unlooked-for results. Talks after class and walks along the road were not the only means by which something akin to friendship developed between me and the five or six members of the little fraternity. Some of them took to inviting me to their homes for tea and in order to meet their parents and other members of the family. Joe was invited too. Sometimes we would be invited together, sometimes on separate occasions. In this way, we had tea in the room behind the tailor's shop where Padam lived, and in the two-story wooden building at 10th Mile, which was Kaka's home, and the hospital bungalow near the church where Sachin resided. At first, these occasions tended to be formal and somewhat constrained, with our hosts doing their best to make us feel at home by giving us an English-style tea and being on tenterhooks, lest they should do anything wrong. After one or two such visits, however, the atmosphere relaxed, and we not only gained a better understanding of the students themselves by seeing them in their own homes, but also made the acquaintance of parents, brothers and sisters and other relations, neighbours and anybody else who happened to look in. It soon became evident what a wealth of goodwill existed towards us among people we had not met before and of whom we had not even heard. Parents, especially, could not sufficiently express their gratitude for what the YMBA was doing for the students, and were always so delighted to see us that we ended up by getting to know some of the fathers almost better than we knew their sons. Joe struck up with old Mr. Lama, Kaka's father, an acquaintance that was to have important consequences both for me personally and for the YMBA. Well, I developed with Dr. Ravi Das Singh, Sachin's father, a friendly understanding that lasted until his death at a relatively early age, 5 or 6 years later. Nonetheless, the principal means of developing our relationship with the students, including even those we knew best, was still the evening tutorial classes. Though the fact that they were now getting private tuition meant that their faces were no longer clouded with gloom, the examinations for which they had to sit towards the end of the year were still their doom, a doom of which they did not play unmindful, and passing their examinations was therefore still the major preoccupation of their lives. This preoccupation did not altogether exclude the cultivation of other interests, especially those which could be regarded as overlapping with their examination subjects. Sachin, Padam and Lachiman were all keen amateur musicians, which meant they were capable of performing on the box harmonium, an instrument that must have been introduced by missionaries during the Victorian period in order to provide an accompaniment for Christian hymns, but which nowadays was more often found giving the same support to Hindu devotional songs. Sachin not only played, but sang, accompanying himself on the harmonium with various trills and arpeggios that he did not always get quite right. He was extremely fond of performing in this manner, and once he got hold of the harmonium, it was difficult for anyone to get it away from him. Though his voice was not very strong, he sang quite well, and I never tired of listening to him as he poured out song after devotional song at the end of the full moon day pujas we held in the shrine room every month. His main interest outside his studies, however, was not so much music as literature, especially English poetry, an interest that overlapped not only with one of his examination subjects, but with my own interests as well. Poetry, in fact, came to form an enduring bond between us and to provide an important element in a steadily growing friendship. Besides being the principal means of developing our relationship with the students, the evening tutorial classes also proved to be an important means of teaching Buddhism. This was particularly true of the English classes, which were devoted not so much to grammar and composition as to English literature, as represented by the matriculation and IA poetry and prose selections. It was not that I deliberately set out to teach Buddhism by this means, or even that I had any prior idea that such a thing was possible. I made the discovery entirely by accident that one could teach Buddhism while teaching English literature, especially English poetry. That teaching English poetry was, in fact, teaching Buddhism. Whoever had compiled the matriculation and IA poetry and prose selections, a portion of which was set by the examiners each year, must have been a great admirer of the Romantic poets, or else have thought that they were particularly well suited to the Indian temperament. Wordsworth, Keats and Shelley all figured prominently in the pages of the slim, paper-bound volume, though Herrick, Browning, Wilfred Owen and Rupert Brooke were also represented. The main prose authors were H.G. Wells and Oscar Wilde. What most of the students wanted from me was simply a paraphrase of such poems as The Cloud or To a Skylark or To Daffodils, a paraphrase they could learn by heart and then reproduce on paper in the examination hall when invited by the question paper to give the meaning of the poem, quote, in your own words. Thus I had to dictate paraphrases beginning in some such manner as, quote, the cloud, speaking like a human being, declares that he brings fresh showers of rain from the seas and the streams. Or, quote, the poet, greeting the skylark enthusiastically as a happy spirit, tells him that he was not ever a bird. Or, quote, the poet informs the daffodils, whom he addresses as beautiful, that he and others like him are unhappy to see them run away so quickly. That was the kind of thing the students expected from me. That's the kind of thing that was acceptable to the examiners and earned good marks. Once I had done my duty by the students, however, and provided them with the sort of paraphrase they wanted, I felt free to go beyond the examination requirements. Taking the paraphrase I had dictated as my starting point, I tried to communicate to them something of the real meaning of the poem as the expression of an intense emotional and intellectual experience, an experience that was of universal significance and value. This involved exploring the connotation of key words, elucidating idiomatic expressions, explaining mythological allusions, and pointing out parallels in ordinary human experience, and so on. Many of the students appreciated this kind of approach. Some, especially Sachin, found it intensely stimulating. One day, when the class was particularly attentive, and I was feeling more than usually inspired, I was explaining the last verse of Shelley's The Cloud and discovering in it greater and greater depths of meaning when I suddenly realised I was teaching the students Buddhism. It was not that I'd forgotten about the poem I was supposed to be teaching and had unconsciously slipped into teaching Buddhism instead. In explaining the poem, I was teaching Buddhism. This could only mean that at a certain level of experience, poetry and Buddhism, poetry and the Dharma, were the same thing. There was a sense in which beauty was truth, and truth beauty. And even if this was not all I needed to know on earth, it had at least become clear to me that my interest in poetry was not incompatible with a spiritual life, as I had sometimes felt, or had been made to feel, but that the two things were complementary aspects of the same process of higher human development. What with sponsoring lectures and educational film shows, opening the recreation hut and starting evening tutorial classes, the YMBA's achievements during the first 3 or 4 months of its existence were not negligible. Swale and I were pleased that it had been possible to do so much since the time when he and I and Dhammajyoti, now safely back in Sarnath, had held our first discussions, and the idea of starting a young men's Buddhist association in Kalimpong had hovered above our heads like a beautiful iridescent ball. Gayan Jyoti was pleased that the Dharmojya Vihara was at last being put to good use. Parents were pleased that their sons were being kept off the streets and given help with their studies. The young men of Kalimpong were pleased that they had a place of their own to which they could go, where they could meet their friends, play games, and receive private tuition. The illiterate were pleased that there were educational film shows for them to see. The literate were pleased that there were interesting lectures for them to attend. Buddhists generally were pleased that there were signs of Buddhist revival in Kalimpong. The only person who was not pleased with what we were doing, with the possible exception of the Christian missionaries, whom I had not yet met, was Great Wisdom. He sat behind his little table in the library with a more and more vindictive smile on his bullfrog face, and spent more and more of his time writing letters on long rolls of paper that curled over the edge of the table and dropped in great coils onto the floor. At first I did not take much notice of him. Ever since my arrival he had shown no disposition to be friendly, and had in fact ignored me as much as possible. It was only when I overheard Nucci arguing hotly with him one day that I realised something was amiss. What the argument was about, Nucci would not say. Eventually I learned that Great Wisdom had been abusing the YMBA to the people who patronised the library, and sending false reports of what was happening at the Vihara to his former disciples in Nepal, and that Nucci, on coming to know this, had decided to have the matter out with him. The reason for the ex-monk's interminable letter-writing was now clear. What was not so clear at this stage, even to Nietzsche, was the harm the long rolls of paper were doing. Uncoiling from the library floor, they were carrying all over Nepal the same lying message. The Nuars had lost control of the Dharmojya Vihara. It had been overrun by low-caste people from the bazaar who were using it for parties and dances. They were, in fact, tearing the place down over his head. If some of the monks did not come soon and help him drive the intruders out, the Vihara would soon be completely destroyed. Even when it became clear what harm Great Wisdom's letters had been doing, I found it difficult to understand how anyone could have taken his allegations seriously. After the establishment of the YMBA, I had written to the Dharmojya Sabha, asking for permission to use the Vihara for our own activities until we were able to acquire a place of our own. And this permission we had received and had gratefully acknowledged in the first issue of Stepping Stones. Our presence in the Vihara was thus perfectly legitimate, and there was no reason for any misunderstanding about it. As for what actually happened at the Vihara, and whether anyone was really tearing the place down over Great Wisdom's head, these were things that could be easily ascertained by anyone living in Kalimpong who cared to interest himself in the matter. The tearing down apparently referred to the removal of a wooden partition in the recreation hut. What was really upsetting Great Wisdom, it seemed, was the fact that the Vihara was being used to such an extent by non-Nuars, particularly by low-caste people from the bazaar, by which he apparently meant Sachin, Padam and Lachuman, and other students belonging to the same low-ranking Nepali Hindu caste. There was a monk he had opposed the caste system in Nepal. In reality, he had opposed it only to the extent that it discriminated against the Nuars. Like many other people, he resented being discriminated against by those who were above him, but had no objection to practicing discrimination himself against those who were below him. It was not so much that he disbelieved in the caste system, as that he wanted a higher place in it for the Nuars. Sectarian narrow-mindedness was not the only reason why Great Wisdom was not pleased with what we were doing. There were also reasons of a more personal nature. Before my arrival on the scene, and particularly before the establishment of the YMBA, not much had happened at the Vihara, not many people came there, and he had more or less complete control over the place. This meant that he was able to let out rooms and sell off bamboos from the Jura without anyone being any the wiser. He was also able to pocket the proceeds. Now that there were so many people around and the rooms were all being used, he could no longer do either of these things. Moreover, he was afraid that the YMBA might take over the running of the library, with the result that he would lose his job, and with it the stipend that was his sole remaining source of income. All this I came to learn only much later. Even if I had known it at the time, it might not have given me so much cause for concern, as did the fact that there was disharmony within the YMBA. Since practically the day of Joe's arrival in Kalimpong, he and Swale had not got on well together. Swale professed himself extremely disappointed with Joe. He had met him only once in Lucknow, he explained, and had no idea what he was really like. Had he known, he would never have invited him up to Kalimpong to join us. Joe, for his part, professed himself extremely disappointed with Swale, as well as with the YMBA. Had he known that we did not have premises of our own, and that a wealthy local Buddhist had not promised to give us 20,000 rupees, as Swale had written and told him, Swale denied this, he would never have left Lucknow, where, in any case, he had all the Buddhist work he wanted. In private, each confided to me what he thought of the other. According to Swale, Joe was not a gentleman. According to Joe, Swale was not a Buddhist. When they met, they sometimes found it difficult to be polite to each other. Swale's attitude towards Joe was one of cold antipathy, as though Joe was a kind of poisonous reptile. Joe's attitude towards Swale was one of icy revulsion, as though Swale was a kind of obscene monster. It was clear that if things continued in this way, there would be room in the YMBA for only one of my two helpers, and that I would have to choose between them. End of chapter 4.